Hey, and welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Kluck, joined by my good friend Barnabas Piper, and no Ronnie Martin today. Today being Holy Week, all of my pastor friends have completely tapped out on other responsibilities in their lives, and I don't ask questions, Barnabas. I kind of give them the space that I feel like they need. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess having grown up in a pastor's house, I have a slightly different view. I understand every pastor thinks this is a busier week. Color me skeptical. I think it's just I think it's a convenient week for them to not answer emails and texts is what this is, and then they go preach the exact same sermon on Sunday. And in fact, they probably are going to preach the same sermon they did last week or last year at this time. I mean.
Oh, there it is, man. Challenging words from Barnabas Piper.
I kid. Now, I kid.
I know. I know.
Well, I got to say that because somebody's going to get offended. We do that on occasion. We offend
people. Well, dude, somebody always gets offended,
That's true.
I mean, you can set your watch by that. And speaking of, I feel like I don't know, man. Let me suss this out to you. Maybe you've noticed this, but I feel like Ronnie Martin brought a different kind of fan base to the Happy Rant, and like I feel like there are people who listen to our program just because they have a weird sort of infatuation with Ronnie. So I feel like that group is going to be disappointed just kind of right off the bat because he's not here. Am I right?
That's true. But if they've gotten this far, it means they already downloaded the podcast, which means we really got what we wanted from them anyway. So problem
yeah,
solved.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, so
yeah,
sorry,
just being
folks.
That this is,
but
this is all just big business, man. It's
yeah,
all just
absolutely.
Numbers and transactions. And speaking of, we have sponsors to throw love to. I will throw my initial bit of love to the boys at Resonate Recordings, who, as always, do a smashing job of making us sound good. Their job will be easier without Ronnie's jankety internet connection today, so they won't have to deal with that. So even the guys at Resonate, I feel like, are going to have a little bit easier Holy Week than they would normally have. So you're welcome, fellas. And Barnabas, tell us about our other sponsor.
Yep, we have Nav Press again. They being a consistent sponsor of ours, coming back with the book "Cry of the Soul: How Our Emotions Reveal Our Deepest Questions About God." This was the same sponsor as we had last episode. So the authors are Dan Allender and Tremper Longman. He of the awesome name.
Tremper.
Tremper. Yep. Longman. What did we decide he was? Was he a
dude? He was like a drummer boy in the Civil War.
Okay.
Was what I decided.
Okay. I couldn't, you know? I remember we touched on possibly like Australian rugby player, possibly like Yale crew rower, possibly.
Dude, yes. Yale crew rower with the sweater tied around the neck was another,
80s,
another good.
I feel like the bad guy in an 80s teen movie, possibly.
Oh, dude, totally. Yeah. Yeah. With the sweater tied around the neck. Like James Spader would have played him in the 80s.
Yes. Exactly. In reality,
like, this is my current boyfriend, Tremper Longman, who's a little jerk.
Yes. In reality, he is an Old Testament prophet, Westminster Seminary.
Things that we mentioned, is he?
What's that?
He's none of those things that we mentioned.
Well, he might have been back in the day. I mean, a lot can change between being 17 and being an OT
dude,
prof.
He may have been. You know what? Let's have a look at him, man. While you're kind of whizzing through the promo, I'm gonna look this guy up.
Wikipedia this thing as per listener suggestion.
Dude, as per listener suggestion, we're doing some research here on the air.
We're going to research on the air. So Tremper Longman, Old Testament prophet, Westminster Seminary, and then Dan Allender, who I mentioned previously. He is a counselor specializing in trauma and abuse victims, but really just kind of covering the spectrum. So between the two of them, they weave together this a look at people's negative emotions and what they tell us about what our heart needs from God and what our heart thinks of God. And so they use the Psalms as sort of a model for that. So this is a great book for people who are doing counseling, for people who are going through a hard time, looking at emotions not as a problem to be solved, but as sort of an indicator of how we relate to and believe about God. So kind of a paradigm shift for how Americans especially think about emotions. So again, the name of the book is Cry of the Soul: How Our Emotions Reveal Our Deepest Questions About God. It's from Nav Press. We really appreciate their sponsorship. It is a fantastic book. You should go check it out. It'll be in the show notes. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at BarnesandNoble.com, wherever you buy your books. Since I work at Lifeway, I'm going to suggest that you go to Lifeway.com and purchase it. But if you're an Amazon shopper, you'll probably get it there because it's faster. So get Cry of the Soul and support Nav Press because they support us.
There it is. So I looked up Tremper Longman, and I was ready to to make more kind of witty observations with my words, except that he just looks like a really nice guy, is all I can say. He just looks like a really decent, you know, just kind of standard pastoral sort of guy. So, yeah, he doesn't look all James Spader-y from the 80s. He doesn't look like a rugby player from Australia or a drummer boy in the Civil War. So, I got nothing.
Do you think his parents gave him that name, like, with aspirations of him being those things, and instead he just turned into a really, really nice Old Testament prof who writes good pastoral things?
Dude, you know, that's a great question. I have no doubt that they had expectations, because we all do for our kids. And yeah, name-wise too, I'm thinking they had to have some big expectations. But you know what? You put almost anything with Longman and it sounds okay. Even like an 80s name like Brett, you know, Brett Longman. You would have been like a defenseman for the, you know, Detroit Red Wings with that name.
Yes, I was thinking hockey player. Of course, I suppose with a name like Brett, you have to be because of Brett Hull, but...
Dude, even a name, even like a real old-timey name like Stan Longman, that sounds kind of awesome. You know what I mean?
Stan Longman sounds like he would have been like one of Louis Zamperini's childhood friends from Unbroken or something like that. You know, the sort
dude,
of that,
seriously. Don't mess with Stan Longman. He rolls his cigarettes up in his shirt sleeves, you know, like that kind of guy.
Exactly.
Dude, I love it. You put almost anything with Barnabas Longman. I like it. Kind of a mouthful, but.
Yeah, that one, I don't know what that one is. Barnabas doesn't have a paradigm. I guess I'm supposed to set the paradigm or something. I don't know.
Dude, how about this one? Ronnie Longman.
Ronnie Longman. Ronnie Longman would be in the movie The Sandlot.
Oh, dude, you're right, man. You're
again,
right.
sort of that era, but like it's – and then he would grow up to be Ronald Longman, who would be probably a CFO somewhere.
Yeah, CFO or a CPA. You do your taxes. Exactly. You know, but as a kid, it'd be like, Mom, can I go play at Ronnie Longman's house again? Exactly. And she'd roll her eyes and like wipe her hands on her apron and be like, ah. Oh. You know, again, Ronnie Longman.
Yeah, that kid.
Can't we have any peace in this house? You know,
be back by dinner.
Be back by dinner. Exactly. Well, speaking of The Sandlot, sort of, The Sandlot has to do with sports. And we got a suggestion for a topic here on the most unlikable sports teams and why we hate them. Now, I have to come clean here in that there aren't a lot of sports teams that I hate. But I recognize that there are teams that other people hate, and I feel like I could suss out why. But I'll open it up with you, Barnabas. Are there teams that you hate?
Well, let me ask you this: I realize that you are a sports fan of the meta variety now, meaning you love the games themselves as opposed to having a diehard rooting interest.
Yeah, for sure.
Was there ever a time when you hated specific teams?
That's tough, man. I don't feel like there was, because even growing up, you know, growing up in the Midwest, growing up in Indiana, I was a Chicago Bears fan, a huge Chicago Bears fan. But even back then, I don't feel like I hated the Packers like a lot of people did. Like I had enough sort of respect for NFL history to kind of have a grudging respect and even like for the Packers at times. The only time I ever hated the Packers, maybe you remember this, you might be too young. We had a quarterback for the Bears named Jim McMahon, obviously, and this was 1986, so it was the year after the Super Bowl year. The Packers had a defensive end named Charles Martin who, like, hit Jim McMahon and just body slammed him on his shoulder, like, you know, 5 minutes after the play was over. So a crazy amount of time elapsed, and then he just grabbed McMahon and just, like pole-axed him into the hard turf there at Soldier Field, and I think I truly hated Charles Martin after that happened because he hurt my quarterback. But no, even as a kid, man, I don't remember having like intense hatred for teams. I'm sure I hated some individual players. I'll give this some thought as you give your answer. But yeah, I'm struggling with this one a little bit.
Well, I could probably take the rest of the podcast on this one because I have sort of eras of hatred or flavors of hatred because – growing up in Minnesota, I grew up four or five blocks from the Metrodome where both the Vikings and the Twins played. Both have had some modicum of success as well as providing numerous seasons of heartbreak. But so growing up, the teams that I hated were their rivals. So,
sure.
The Packers, especially during the Brett Favre era. Brett Favre is a football player who I respect to the utmost and abhor completely. Mm. And,
now talk about the hatred vis-a-vis Brett Favre. I want you to, you know, kind of unpack that.
I feel like I'm going to Dan Allender for counseling right now.
Yeah, I know, man. Yeah, just dig deep. Keep digging.
Talk about that. It's very hard to hate a player who is mediocre unless sure. they're a dirty player. Brett Favre was not mediocre. He was phenomenal. So he beat the Vikings with regularity, especially at Lambeau.
Yep.
But he just was that like exuberant, obnoxious, get it. I mean, I remember when he tried to pick a fight with John Randall. Now, John Randall was this war-painted 290-pound.
That just doesn't seem very wise to me. You know, Randall seemed truly scary.
Right. He was a terrifying human being on the football field. I think he's pretty nice off the football field. But that was Favre. Like, he was just this insane competitor, which means that if somebody was a Packers fan, I'm sure that they loved him to death because he's the kind Absolutely. Of guy who, if he's on your team, you love him. If he's not on your team, you hate him. With that said, when he came to the Vikings in 2011, I think it was, I still hated him because
really?
I knew without a shadow of a doubt from the moment they signed him, they were going to be very good that year. And then he was going to ruin the season for them. And the season ended with a pick on an ill-advised classic Brett Favre throwback across the field dumb play yep. against the New Orleans Saints, and I wasn't even shocked. I was like, well, who didn't see that coming? All he needed to do was run out of bounds, and they had a field goal, and instead he threw a pick.
Can I just say about that game against the Saints, though, and I didn't have a dog in that fight, meaning that I didn't have a huge rooting interest one way or the other, but, dude, the beating that Favre absorbed in that game – was one of the most savage things I've ever seen in pro football. And that ended up being – that was one of the bounty games, right?
Yes, that was one of the games. Favre and Percy Harvin. So two – that was, I think, Harvin's rookie year. He was a really explosive player. Those were two of the players that there was evidence that Greg Williams and the Saints defense targeted them, and they had bounties on them. So $1,000 if you knock them out of the game or whatever it was. So – but, yes, he took a royal beat down in that game. So
– yeah. And just kept pulling himself up off the carpet, and coming back for more, which is really impressive, I thought.
Which is one of the reasons that Favre is both lovable if you loved the Packers and hateable if you didn't, because he was such a gritty gamer, and gritty gamers are annoying as all get out if you root against them.
Yeah, exactly. And exuberant people are annoying if you root against them. Yes. See also Cam Newton, who, I can't say that I hate the Panthers, but I think I went through periods of like, hate is a strong word, but like probably actual hatred for Cam Newton's ethos, just his way of carrying himself, you know?
When we talked about that one on another podcast, because I kind of liked it. But again, I have enough distance from the Panthers that I have completely neutral feelings. And I just thought it was kind of fun. And he's a great quarterback, which is probably how a lot of people felt towards Favre. They're like, oh, that's Brett being Brett. And
exactly.
But I couldn't stand him. And then after I moved to Chicago for college and a few years after, then I stopped hating the Packers and started hating the Bears because nothing is worse than rooting against a team and living in their backyard. And Bears fans are a special breed of obnoxious too. So no
Dude, talk about that now because I am a Bears fan and my family's from Chicago. So to me, like the fan base always just seemed – it just seemed normal. You know, like Chicago sports radio and – I guess just the vibe of the Bears fans seem normal to me.
I should say Chicago fans in general. It's not just the Bears. It's also it's also the Bulls. It's also – but especially the Cubs and the White Sox.
Now, if you would for me describe like the Chicago fan.
The Chicago fan is not a sports fan. Okay. They don't know anything about the sport itself or any other team in the league.
Okay.
They only know their team. And so if you bring up football, all they can say is, da, Bears. You know, like that's – Bill Swirsky's super fans are – I think those are actual Bears fans. I don't think –
Which is one of the great sketches of all time.
Oh, hilarious.
I mean, truly. Yeah, legendary.
It's one of those classic, it's funny because it's true skits.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Kind of like the parodies of Donald Trump. They're not – You won't find many Cubs fans who actually love baseball.
Dude, yeah, so I feel like there's different genres of Chicago fans. I mean, you got your Bill Swirsky, you know, super fan type, and I had these guys in my family, distant relatives who were like, anytime the Bears lost, like, oh, they should fire Ditka, they should cut, you know, everybody. And I mean, these guys were just passionate with like no direction. You know what right. I mean? So yeah, what you said about knowledge, I think rings true there.
And all Bears fans are still living in 1985, even if they were born in 1992.
Oh, dude, including myself, man. I'm guilty as charged on that one. I mean, that was such a magical – I've got all the games on DVD.
On the plus side, you remember 1985.
Oh, yeah. I was in fourth grade, which was just the really the sweet spot for caring about sports. And you're not all jaded. You don't know, like, all the dark sides of everything. So it was amazing. I think the other Chicago sports fan, though, is sort of the – you know, you're kind of affluent Northside yuppie who just, you know, goes to a couple Cubs games a year, you know, buys the jersey, also doesn't know anything about the team. But yeah, it's kind of into it because it's the thing that you're supposed to be into in Chicago. You know what I mean?
Well, the reputation of Cubs fans, especially because they were terrible for so long, granted, that ship seems to have turned and they seem to be a pretty good baseball team now. But sure. The people used to go to Cubs games to be seen, not to see the game. I mean, it was
absolutely.
You had your bleacher bums who were out there to get sun and drink old style. And then you had everybody, the closer you got to home plate, the richer they got, the smaller the tank tops got, and the prettier they got. And they were there just to kind of that, because that was the North Side scene. And
it was a social event.
White Sox fans are just embittered, angry, inferiority complex because nobody cares about the White Sox in Chicago except for like – there's like 100,000 fans total.
Yeah, like tough, jaded Southsiders, man. You know,
they like to think of themselves that way anyway. There are some of them, and then there's a bunch who just – they're the younger brother of a Cubs fan, and so they just picked the White Sox because they couldn't stand what the older brother was rooting for.
That's right.
And I – yeah, so the White Sox were another team that I – cannot stand and couldn't stand. And but then there's another category of teams, and that's just like the unlikable team in general. So
okay.
Like the New York Yankees and the Los Angeles Lakers.
Sure.
Just
also Duke, right? I'm pretty sure this got suggested because we're in March Madness and somebody hates, you know, Duke ethos.
Although here's the thing. I don't feel this way about all the hateable teams because I actually like the Patriots and I kind of like Duke.
Yeah. Dude, I actually love the Patriots, man. I'm fascinated by them. I'm fascinated by Belichick. I think they're an amazing team. The way they reload, retool, you know, they just find a way, which is amazing to me.
But they're definitely one of the bad guys of the NFL. Like they,
oh for sure, yeah.
Push
everybody
the
likes
limits
to get
of the rules. Everybody hates good teams, or especially consistently good teams. So they're definitely one of the most hateable teams. I just don't hate them in particular.
Yeah, people like to get all indignant about the cheating and, you know, all of that stuff, which I just roll my eyes at. Dude, the Duke thing, I could kind of get there. If I cared more about college basketball, I would probably hate Duke. I mean, just the kind of old money.
Coach K
in the 90s. Yeah.
Coach K is one of the smuggest, smarmiest people in the world. I mean, just
right.
If I had a rooting interest in college basketball, I'm certain that I would abhor him completely. But I watch college basketball from a distance, and so guys like Coach K and Coach Calipari at Kentucky, who's another highly hateable person, I just sort of look at it and I'm like, they're really good coaches. And that's kind of the extent of my feelings towards them.
Dude, you know who I kind of hate in college sports? And this is going to make me some enemies back in my former – the former place where I lived. I really kind of hate Michigan State, to be honest.
Oh, I was hoping you would say Jim Harbaugh.
No, dude, I kind of dig Harbaugh, man. Going back to like, I had a job in high school. I don't know if I ever told you this, but I was a ball boy for the Colts when Harbaugh was there.
I think you mentioned that at one time. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and he was super cool. I mean, he was just an exceedingly cool, charismatic, competitive guy. And I used to catch passes from him. I used to warm him up before practice, which was a blast. But I'm kind of into the whole Harbaugh Michigan thing, and I guess I've always, you know, in the Michigan State rivalry, I've always gravitated toward Michigan just because of the helmets, the history, you know, all the above. But Michigan State fans tend to be really obnoxious, probably in the same way that you describe White Sox fans. I mean, just a chip on the shoulder, a sense of inferiority that's probably well founded. And yet they're not dealing with it very well. You know what I mean? They consistently deal with it in a really negative way.
Even
like
though
Bernie
they've
Soap
been
is.
Good for what, like 5 or 6
Dude,
years
they
now?
They've been really legitimately good in basketball for a long time, and they've been quite good in football for five or six years now. But
although after last weekend they don't seem in basketball, their fans should be upset. That was a rough way
Dude,
to end
right.
the season.
Middle Tennessee State, right?
Yeah, go Murfreesboro, Tennessee.
That's right, man. Go whatever they are. What are they? Middle Tennessee State.
It's probably something to do with an animal with claws. I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm thinking.
Or maybe a dog.
But yeah,
of
Michigan
some
State. If pressed, I would say that's a team that I dislike. Yeah. But you were saying about the Lakers and about the Yankees.
Yeah, just – I think – okay, here's – the thing that drives me nuts about those teams is not just their success. Although for a long time the Yankees played by different rules than everybody else because they could just outspend everyone. That has leveled off a little bit, not so much an issue anymore. It's the fact that what those fans do is they look at every other team in the league and they start talking about the other team's players as if they are theirs. So when that guy is on our team, just with the attitude of, oh,
yeah, as though the whole league is just like,
right.
Yeah, we're just going to shop for the best players on everyone else.
Everybody's a farm team for the Yankees.
That's it.
So I remember when Joe Mauer for the Twins was an MVP caliber player a few years ago, Yankees reporters were talking about when his contract was up and they what would it look like if they signed him? And I'm like, he's a Twin for 3 more years. And there's no guarantee he's going to sign with you. Maybe he hates the Yankees as much as everybody else does because he grew up in Minnesota. And so it was that attitude, just that attitude of complete smug superiority. Like they genuinely think that they're qualitatively better as people, as an organization, as a city. Like there's just no question in their mind that everybody else should bow at their feet.
Exactly.
That is a very hateable attitude.
Dude, you know what? I thought of another one while you were talking, and this has more to do with just aesthetics, both of the game and of the uniform. I really hate Oregon football.
You hate the way they play football?
I hate, yes, at times. I'm not a spread offense guy, so we've talked about this ad nauseum on and off the air, but I hate bubble screens. I don't like the spread. Oregon is sort of a signature spread team. They were early adopters, and they've run that offense for a long time. So I think I've disliked watching their games for a long time because of that, and they're always on at night. They're often on the kind of big ABC game at night. And I hate the changing uniforms every game thing. And I don't so much even hate it for Oregon because they were first to do it. I hate the way that, you know, Middle Tennessee State and Bowling Green and like, you know, all these teams, Toledo, all these teams that have no business doing that are now doing it. Indiana, you know, it's like, really?
Yeah, I think, I feel like you need to like, earn the right to do that. So win a certain number of conference championships, possibly national championships. Like Alabama could do it. Now, the thing is, Alabama is going to throw up the bird at that because they're like, why do we need to do that? We're crimson and cream, and we just beat everybody every year in our traditional uniforms, which, by the way, looks way better. Yeah.
I love that attitude, and I love Alabama's classic uniform. There's just some like – there's some respect for the game issues tied up in that for me, and I realize I'm sounding like an old person. But
so the two teams that started it were Oregon and Maryland. Maryland is in the backyard of Under Armour. And so they're like the test case schools for anything that basically those businesses just donate stuff to them, and they're like, hey, here's a new uniform. And and it's just free advertising. Now, Maryland is a mediocre at best football program, so that's a little weird. At least Oregon's had some success. But yeah,
dude, Maryland's attempts at doing that were like, do you ever have a guy at like your high school who wasn't cool? He was like quantifiably uncool, but he bought the shoes that he thought were going to make him cool, and they didn't.
Yes,
that's how I feel when I see Oregon in the alternate Maryland in the alternate uniforms.
Yep,
like it's just a sad attempt to raise your program to a certain level that it's never going to be at.
When you're a 7-6 Big Ten team, looking cool, just sorry, it's not working.
Oh, dude, and that color scheme is just vomit-esque. It's so bad. You know what? I hate Maryland too. Let's end the segment there.
Done.
So speaking of fan bases, this is a weird sort of segue, but I think you'll get it once I get there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that seems to be just so prevalent in our culture right now and prevalent in social media is this idea of solidarity. So everybody standing with everybody in the wake of everything. So something happens in the news and you change your status or your photograph or whatever to reflect your solidarity with whoever the bad thing has just happened to. Dude, my question is, what is this phenomenon, man? And what is solidarity even? Like, what are we even doing? Like, it costs me nothing to say, you know, I stand with France after the Paris bombings. And I've lived in France and I've been to Paris and I love that city and I love the people that I know there. But I feel like it's almost more insulting or more kind of patronizing to say, you know, from across the ocean where it costs me nothing, I stand with you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I think to put a positive spin on it, my guess is most people are not – most people are probably trying to do something good or something they perceive as good. My guess is most people have also not through how cheap and meaningless what they're doing is. You know, and I even think this is true at like the governmental level when you look around and like, okay, the pyramids in Egypt are colored with – now it's the Belgian flag after the incident in Brussels or things like that. Now it's one thing if Paris lights up a monument on behalf of Brussels, because those are almost like sister cities when it comes to tragedy now.
Yeah.
But when you know, when they light up the pyramids, or it's in London, or it's in Washington D.C., even that, I'm just kind of like, what? That's an Instagram opportunity. That's not that doesn't mean much. Now that's, and I think social media is something where people don't know how to feel. People don't know how to deal with tragedy. People don't know how to reflect. People don't know – they don't want to be afraid. There's a sense of sort of like, we're all together in this, which gives a false sense of confidence as opposed to just sort of weeping with those who weep. I mean, I think it's the opposite of doing that. It's not actually doing that. Now, there will be those who do it out of that heart, and you can't – I can't judge the motives of it. But the I just know that it's the case because of the sheer numbers. Most people who do things are not doing it from any sort of reflective stance, I wouldn't think, because most people aren't terribly reflective.
Yeah. Dude, do you feel like – and I feel like we've hit this a ton on the show, and maybe it's just indicative of where we are as a culture that the conversation always kind of circles back around to this. But do you think that social media presence has kind of eroded our ability to reflect, to like actually reflect? And to actually be sad and to actually mourn with people who are mourning. Do you think it somewhat cheapens that process to be able to just float out a status or, you know, retweet a photo or whatever, when in fact what we really need to be doing is truly reflecting on what's happened?
Yeah, I think reflect has become react. And and usually it's reacting in an incredibly abbreviated fashion because it doesn't take anything. It's more of a reflection to write a 300-word blog post. Even if what you say is fairly mundane, that took something from you to invest thought, some heart in that, something along those lines. To put a red, white, and blue filter on your avatar or whatever it is, that doesn't take anything. And it doesn't mean anything. And then some people leave that on. And you can tell it doesn't mean anything because people leave it on there for like 9 months after the fact, even though the news cycle has since forgotten about that incident 25 times over. And we know this is the case because look at what trends on Twitter. Yeah. So, you know, Brussels bombing will trend for maybe 3 to 4 days.
Yeah.
And that's a long cycle if it makes it past 3 days.
Exactly.
And then we're on to something else. You know, it's going to be March Madness again come Thursday and that kind of thing. And all of a sudden – so it's just I do think it's completely killed our ability to reflect, but I think that suits people just fine because reflecting is hard and it's uncomfortable, especially when people are dying.
Yeah, exactly, man. It is hard and uncomfortable. And I think one of the reasons we love – things like March Madness in the NFL is that it does provide a bit of a release. I mean, it's a little bit of a safety valve in society to be able to talk about those things which are safe and escapist and all that. But yeah, it's just funny, man, the cycle of this whole thing. I remember 10 years ago kind of harumphing about, well, something hasn't really happened unless you've blogged about it, you know. And now, like, we long for the days of the 300-word blog post.
Right.
That seems like long-form thoughtfulness compared to, you know, dashing off a tweet or just retweeting something that you've seen. So
yeah, and I guess the thing that I would want to say to our listeners so that they don't feel like we're just – I mean, I probably sounded far more judgmental than you did. When I see people do that stuff, I don't think idiot. I just think that didn't add anything. You can do just as much good for people who are hurting on the other side of the world by silently praying or having a conversation with a friend about how to think about these things than you can by changing your Twitter avatar or hashtagging something. I mean, hashtag activism is not activism.
Yeah, exactly, man. Exactly. Yeah, it's so true, man. And you know, having conversations with your wife about it, conversations with your kids about it. I mean, this is the reality of living in a broken, fallen world, you know, and I think, you know, we're not going to make any significant change by, you know, what we're doing on Twitter. You know, the significant change is going to come from, you know, what we teach our kids and how we teach them to live in society and talk through things and think through things and, you know, how we model that for them at this point. So yeah, it's interesting, man. And this is actually a great segue into our last topic, which is kind of in the social media age. And again, this is a thing that we kind of hit on over and over. But what does it mean to be an expert in this age? and this is something that I talk about a lot, actually, with my mass media students. You know, just the idea of expertise. And I think millennials are a little bit more uncomfortable with the idea of there even being an expert because they've kind of grown up in this populist environment where everybody's a musician, everybody's a publisher because the means of production are there for people to do all those things on their own. So, whereas you and I grew up in an era where, you know, you had to be vetted by a magazine publisher, for example, before you got an article, you know, out there for public consumption, or you had to be vetted by a book publisher. And there is something special about that, I think. But in this age, man, and in this generation, I wonder what the word expert even means.
I think it means whatever you want it to mean. I think it has become a self-claimed title. And that's the downside of a good thing happening. You know, you mentioned that anybody can publish, anybody can make music, anybody can put stuff out there. Entrepreneurialism is on the rise. I think that's all a good thing. You know, creating opportunities. You don't have to go through sort of the old boys club to arrive anymore. The downside is that there's not qualifications anymore.
Yeah.
You know, just because somebody has a master's degree doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't mean they're actually better at something than somebody who's just learned it on their own. Whereas it used to be, if you saw a master's degree, if you saw Dr. So-and-so, that really meant something. And now it's kind of like, well, they may or may not be an expert either.
Dude, are there –
Go ahead.
Are there titles that mean anything anymore?
I think in certain fields there are. I think, I think doctors still mean something, particularly in fields of like science and mathematics and like, you know, those kinds of things. I think, you know, working in the Southern Baptist world, doctor is a completely meaningless title. You know, there are churches of 120 people in rural Tennessee who have, you know, if they're looking for a pastor, they're like doctorate preferred.
That's
because you can get a doctor for like $45 and 3 hours online or something like that. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but
it doesn't qualify
you to be a pastor.
Thing, you know?
What's that?
Right. Yeah. It's kind of supply and demand, you know, I mean, with more guys going to seminary, I mean, there's more doctors and it just kind of means less.
It's a nebulous field, you know, getting a doctorate in theology might mean a ton, or it might mean that you went to a podunk school with somebody who is overseeing your doctorate, who is, you know, like your daddy's best friend. And that stuff happens a lot. And so somebody comes out with a doctorate that's almost unearned. And then there's other people who get a, you know, doctorate in theology from Cambridge or Oxford or under a supervisor who was rigorous and really pushed them, and for them it actually means something, but you just don't know. Whereas like if you see a medical doctor, you kind of know what that means. Now there are good doctors and bad doctors, but they all went through years and years of school and proved themselves along the way.
And if you're sick or like, you know, injured, they kind of hold your life in their hands, which to me is still really impressive. Now, dude, I'm fascinated by the whole honorary doctorate thing. do you think Do you think we could find any accredited institution of higher learning that would give this program and give us honorary doctorates for being radio personalities in this internet age?
That's a good question.
Dude, because I would – I'm going to tell you right now, I would love an honorary doctorate, man.
Do you have to have a master's degree to get an honorary doctorate?
I don't think you do. I think you can skip right over that.
Because I think you and Ronnie have master's degrees. I do not. And so I'm – I would be leapfrogging. Unless I can get an honorary master's as well, I'd take one of those.
Dude, now I've never heard of anyone getting an honorary master's, but I like that concept.
I mean, baby steps. I'll take them in the sequence they come. I'm not picky.
Maybe we could get you an honorary master's, and then we could get honorary. I would even take. You know what? I would take an honorary bachelor's, just in a different field.
Oh yeah. Than it's like a double major that you never had to study.
It's a double major that you never had to do the work for. I would take that. I would absolutely take that, dude. You know what? An example of my arrogance in this area, vis-a-vis. Experts and not caring about experts. We had to go to this fundraiser. It was a private school fundraiser. And I realized, dude, there's just nobody that I want to sit in a room and listen to. You know what I mean? Like, yep. There was a guy, he came in, he gave a talk. It's always a guy giving a talk. I mean, this is just kind of standard for these fundraisers. But dude, the list of people who I want to sit in a room and listen to is like three people long, you know? Mike Ditka is on the list, but I don't know.
This guy was
credentialed like to high heaven. You know, he had all these doctorates, and you know, he was supposed to give this really interesting talk about I don't know, C.S. Lewis or whatever. And I don't know, man. Maybe it's just I don't know the circles we run in, and having grown up kind of in a way sitting through talks like that.
I think experts, especially in a place like that, there is still a perceived expertise by a lot of people who I mean, we run in privileged circles in a lot of ways, meaning we cross paths with those who other people think are experts. I grew up in a home of one. You have co-authored with many, or we've been at conferences with them. And you come to find out that they're pretty normal people. And that's not a shot at them. Right. You're not saying, well, they're dumb. No, they're not dumb. They're just – they're people who study hard. They say good things, but like they're just pretty normal people. And so it kind of takes the shine off of expert. And then the other thing is when you're in the publishing industry, or probably the education industry, or in my case the marketing industry, you run across a ton of people who are self-proclaimed experts, and you realize that they have huge followings and they're saying nothing important or nothing novel at all. Marketing is full of people who just talk garbage. And it's and people pay them money to say dumb stuff.
It's so true, man. And there's such a scheme or an intentionality behind. And you and I have sat in on these meetings both as authors and as people in the book business. Like, you know, marketing people are forever going, you know, how could we get you on TV to talk about sports so that people will buy your sports book? Like, you need to be perceived as an expert in that field. And it's like, well, like, don't I need to actually kind of be an expert? You know, like, shouldn't I have coached?
I think when it comes to experts, perception is reality, which is why in the marketing field, all it takes is somebody to have enough misplaced self-confidence to say, I can sell my ideas. And then they go sell them. And you're like, that's not even a good idea. All it takes is enough people to buy it so that you get enough capital that you can sell your next idea. And I mean, it's the same as true with authors, but I waffle on this all the time because I'm arrogant enough to look at those people and think I know more than they do, or I'm smarter than they are.
Yeah.
But then I'm also, on the other hand, realistic enough, maybe it's humility enough to say, but it doesn't make sense to sell that. Like, that's just something if I should just share with people if I know it, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's sort of this, could I be a self-proclaimed expert? Or you certainly could. I probably could. And I think it's slimy though.
I think it is slimy too, man. I totally agree. And I think of myself, and I think if I were ever to be an expert, it would only be on a very tiny little section of things. You know what I mean? Probably such a niche that nobody would even care. And I like the idea. I think just fundamentally, I like the idea of there being fewer experts and the word expert meaning more.
Yes.
Rather than there being a whole, metaphorically speaking, room full of experts and then the word not meaning a whole lot.
Yeah, it means a lot more to me when somebody reaches out to me through you know, Facebook or Twitter and whatever and says, hey, would you mind answering a couple questions about X? And they do it privately, and I can respond to them privately instead of me feeling like I should put myself in the position where I field people's questions.
Right, because where you're doing the slimy thing where you're like, hey, any and all pastor's kids, ask me because I'm the authority. I'm the voice on what it means to be a pastor's kid, you know. Yeah, you would just hate that person.
Yeah, if I became that person, I would expect somebody to tell me to shut up. That would because I should be annoying to people in that case.
And you would be, and hopefully Ronnie and I would have the strength of character to tell you to shut up.
The cojones, if you will.
I will. Folks, cojones, that's a good one to end on. I am Ted Kluck. He is Barnabas Piper. We have wandered to and fro. And until next time, Rachel the Held Evans.
Rejoice always. Pray without ceasing. Give thanks in all circumstances. God invites us to cultivate thankful hearts by turning our eyes toward Him in good times and bad. To listen to more Abide Christian Meditations, just go to lifeaudio.com or search your favorite podcast app for Abide Christian Meditation. You can also download the Abide app for more biblical meditations at abide.com.